This is VOA News. Reporting by remote, I'm Joe Ramsey. U.S. Senate negotiators have reached a bipartisan framework for legislation responding to the recent mass shootings in Buffalo, New York, and Uvalde, Texas. AP correspondent Ben Thomas reports.
It's a measured breakthrough offering modest gun curbs and bolstering efforts to improve school safety and mental health programs. The proposal falls short of tougher curbs sought by President Biden and many Democrats, but even so, if it leads to the enactment of legislation, it would represent a turn after years of gun massacres that have yielded little but stalemate in Congress. In a statement, the president says while it does not do everything he thinks is needed, it reflects important steps in the right direction. 20 senators, including 10 Republicans, have already released a statement calling for passage. Leaders hope to push any agreement into law quickly, they hope this month. Ben Thomas, Washington.
Ukraine's president says Ukrainian forces are defying expectations by preventing Russian troops from overrunning eastern Ukraine. AP correspondent Karen Chalmers reports.
In his nightly video address, President Volodymyr Zelensky said he was proud of the Ukrainian defenders that are managing to hold off Russian troops in the eastern Donbass region. Do you remember how Russia hoped to capture the entire Donbass by early May? It's now the 108th day of the war. It's June already and Donbass is still holding on. After failing to capture the capital Kyiv early on in the war, the Russians focused on capturing the parts of the Donbass region that was still under Ukrainian control. However, the move proved to be more challenging than expected and has turned into a long, laborious battle, thanks in part to the Ukrainian military's use of Western-supplied weapons. I'm Karen Chamas.
And this is VOA News. The state of Tasmania has become the first jurisdiction in Australia to raise the minimum age of incarceration. The move has been welcomed by Indigenous legal and human rights groups and reignited calls for nationwide reform. From Sydney, VOA's Phil Mercer reports.
In Australia, it's estimated that 600 children aged between 10 and 13 have been incarcerated in the past year. Two-thirds are Indigenous. Campaigners have argued that children of that age should be at home or at school and not in handcuffs or prison cells. The authorities in Tasmania agree. It will be Australia's first state or territory to raise the minimum age of inmates in youth detention from 10 to 14. The changes are due to take place in 2024. Cheryl Axelby is the co-chair of Change the Records, a First Nations organisation that lobbies for reform in the criminal justice system. She says young people shouldn't be locked up.
Children are actually harmed throughout their lifetime once they've actually gone through the criminal justice system. Having intervention prevention, which is something that we have really strongly advocated across the nation, means that children get a therapeutic response. It means that they get the supports and targeted responses. There is great support in our community that they would like to see more therapeutic responses than us criminalising our children.
Campaign groups also want Australia to increase the minimum age of criminal responsibility from 10 years to at least 14. Last year, several UN members called on Australia to act on the recommendations. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Pope Francis said Sunday he hoped to visit the Democratic Republic of Congo and South Sudan as soon as he is healthy enough. The 85-year-old said after delivering his weekly prayer in St. Peter's Square, quote, I truly feel great sorrow for having had to postpone this trip, which means so much to me. I apologize for this. The Vatican on Friday announced the trip planned for July 2nd to 7th would be rescheduled, although no new date was set. Francis has been suffering from pain in his right knee and last month was seen using a wheelchair for the first time at a public event. Recapping our top story, U.S. Senate bargainers have announced a bipartisan framework responding to last month's mass shootings in New York and Texas. It's a measured breakthrough offering modest gun curbs and bolstered efforts to improve school safety. The proposal falls far short of tougher curbs long sought by President Joe Biden and many Democrats. Even so, if it does pass, it would signal a turn after years of stalemates in Congress. Reporting by remote, I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C.
What those candidates say is the issue of age. People are complaining that and both of them are septuagenarians. Bola Ahmed Tinubu is 17 and Atiku is 75. So they complain that these are 50-year-old men. So these are some of the issues around their candidates.
Nigeria's Independent National Electoral Commission says presidential candidates should name their running mates June 17th.
One of the presenters is Gerard Kaufman. This is the person who have worked in infrastructure flooding in the New Jersey and Delaware. Actually, he is the guru when it comes to flooding. And then he did a presentation talking about how some of these issues can be addressed.
A conference to help find solutions to perennial flooding in part of the Ghanaian capital Accra ends in Wilmington, Delaware.
What we are seeing in our report is that the Security Council should include climate change, its effect on international security as part of its primary responsibility for the maintenance of peace and security. You know, this is an issue that cannot be ignored.
And a new report warns that countries in the Middle East and North Africa will soon face a rise in armed conflict due to climate change. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. In Nigeria, the Independent National Electoral Commission says presidential candidates should name their running mates June 17. Officials say it forms part of the electoral body's calendar to organize next year's general election. Local media report Asiwaju Bola Ahmed Tinubu, presidential candidate of the ruling All Progressive Congress, and former Vice President Atiku Abubakar from the main opposition People's Democratic Party, are busy in wide consultations to choose their respective candidates. Analysts say they expect next year's presidential election to be competitive between the two veteran politicians, but they caution that Peter Obi, who is representing the Labour Party, could play a key role in determining who becomes the country's next president due to support he is generating among the youth. Nigerians are scheduled to choose a new president, Senate, governors, House of Representatives and local representatives in elections next year. For the latest political developments, I reach political analyst Ibrahim Momo.
For what we are hearing from the two major political parties, the PDP's Atiku Abubakar is considering one of four sitting governors. We have the governor of Delta State, we have the governor of Akwa Ibom State, we have the governor of River State, and of course the governor of Enugu State. So the three governors I mentioned are from the South-South geopolitical zone. That's for the PDP, the main opposition party. For the current ruling party, Bola Ahmed Tinubu happens to be a Muslim, and then he's from the South. If he's to choose a running mate from the Muslim majority north, there is the fear that, and although it's not an issue, it's not about policy, but because of how prominent primordial sentiments, issues of tribe or ethnicity, and indeed religion, the kind of importance or primacy they give to it in Nigeria, there's the fear among some political commentators and other religious groups that the APC might field a running mate who is also a Muslim, although that is not and shouldn't be an issue.
So the concentration basically is on who the two major parties' presidential candidates will choose as their running mate in the upcoming elections. However, I've also heard about waves Peter Obi, former governor, is making among the country's youth. Some people are saying the Labour Party, just a chunk of supporters from the youth and workers in the country, could also have an impact on who becomes the next president. What is the situation on the ground about that?
Well, that's a very, very key issue you have raised. I say that because the former governor of Anambra State from Southeast Nigeria, Peter Obi, was an apparent under the PDP. He actually did buy a phone, the phone, and for the 2 million naira phone. But just before the primaries were held, he pulled out and joined the Labour Party. Now, since he joined the Labour Party, it has become an item. It has become an issue of much interest. What we can see is that Peter Obi is really, you know, his candidate is really making some serious, gathering a lot of momentum from the populace. In fact, people are attributing this renewed vigor or interest in registration to vote to Peter Obi's candidacy.
Looking at the two major political parties, talking about Asiwaju Bola Ahmed Tinubu, the Jagavan, as they call him by his teaming supporters, representing the APC, and former Vice President Atiku Abubakar vying for the presidency on the party ticket of the People's Democratic Party of the PDP. How competitive do you think this elections will be?
It's going to be very, very competitive because one of the reasons why it's going to be competitive is because the incumbent president, Muhammadu Buhari, is not going for re-election. Ordinarily, you'd expect that if he was going for re-election, he would have a kind of edge in the power of incumbency. Another thing that makes it far much more competitive is the fact that both candidates you have mentioned, Asiwaju Bola Ahmed Tinubu and Alhaji Atiku Abubakar, seem to be veterans. Asiwaju Bola Ahmed Tinubu has played a very critical role, if you mind, I'll say a defining role in choosing the last president, the person who have won the last three presidential elections. When Goodluck Jonathan, the military president, won in 2011, Asiwaju Bola Ahmed Tinubu was a key supporter, and it helped to make him win. When President Muhammadu Buhari won in 2015 and 2019, he had the firm support also of Asiwaju Bola Ahmed Tinubu. So these are two veteran politicians, if I could use that appellation. You know, they are well-known politicians, particularly in the presidential race, and they have tended to... So both of them facing off in the 2023 presidential election makes it, you know, a very keenly contested election. However, when we look at it, both of these parties have where they draw their membership from. Another challenge that both candidates face is the issue of age. People are complaining that and both of them are septuagenarians. Bola Ahmed Tinubu is 17, Atiku is 75. So they're complaining that these are 50-year-old men. So these are some of the issues around their candidates.
Ibrahim Momo is a Nigerian political analyst. He spoke with me from Nigeria's Edo State. A conference to help find solutions to perennial flooding in parts of the Ghanaian capital, Accra, has ended in Wilmington, Delaware. Sponsored by the University of Delaware's College of Engineering, the mini-workshop brought together members of the academia, technocrats, and experts on solving flooding issues around the world. Some of the issues discussed include the impact of the problem on health, food security, infrastructure, waste, transportation, and energy. The expert also produced recommendations which they say, if fully implemented, will solve yearly flooding in Accra. For more about the meeting, I reach conference chair Ni Ato Okain. He is a professor of civil and environmental engineering at the University of Delaware and an interim academic director of the university's cybersecurity initiative.
What we realize here is that this issue is going to continue. So we decided to have a conference, or what I will call a mini workshop, to bring experts who are familiar with these type of issues around the world to provide, you know, ideas, programs in the way to address this very important problem. And the country or the city of Accra can then prepare for the future and be a resilient capital or resilient city as we move forward. Yeah.
So with the recommendations, how will this be transmitted to the people of Accra, or for that matter, the government in Accra, to implement in order to prevent future occurrences of flooding in the capital?
The way the conference was set up is such that we need the government, and we need individuals who can help For example, one of the things we look at the conference is that how instead of making a broad global regional plan for the capital, whether we can create a, what I call a small local unit, depending on the neighborhood, depending on the areas, so that a particular drainage problem can be solved. Because what we can see now in Accra is that we have what we call infrastructure desert. What do I mean by infrastructure desert? There are certain parts of the city, you know, you can call Jamestown, you can call Nima, where the infrastructure monitoring and distance has been lacking. So it becomes like a desert. And then the government has focused heavily where I'll say that the middle class are staying. And since everything is interdependent in the city, doing one work or working on one maintenance issue and leaving the others will ultimately affect the whole city.
What are the other major recommendations that you think might help in addressing this perennial problem?
One of the first issues we realized or we came out from the meeting is that first, the city should have what we call the flood risk map, right? And this flood risk map can do what I call what-if scenarios, whether there is a flooding around Koli Lagoon, how would this affect the Kolebu Hospital? Whether there's flooding around, let's say, Labadi, Beshi Lagoon and others, how this will affect our critical military installation, how it will affect the major hospital, 10-7 military hospital, you know. So first, we need to develop this type of flood risk map. Furthermore, there are certain areas like Nima where we can encourage the people, especially through the religious aspect that, okay, please, we want you to help us to monitor what is going on with your infrastructure. And then the government needs to train, you know, these are not engineers or technicians, a basic, you know, people with what I call senior high school certificate, how to collect information about the infrastructure and then send it to the local government, send it to the ministry that, listen, we have a drainage here, but this drainage has not been working for a while. We are not waiting for the government to have their major plan every year to come down to do. We, the people, we are providing you this information to help us. Yeah.
Sometimes people often say that they need indigenous African solutions to African problems, and that when some of these conferences are held outside the continent or abroad, people are resistant into accepting the recommendations that could possibly help address the problem. How will this be different?
Well, first and foremost, I'm the chairman of the workshop, and I grew up in Accra. Most of I grew up in Jamestown, so I really knew the problem. I have people on the list who have worked all over the world, who have addressed similar problems in Manila, you know, Asia countries, South America, and others. And some of these drainage and infrastructure problems, they are worldwide problems. You know, people talk about the climate change and everything. Some countries have gone through the process they are going through. And then most of the people who presented the conference are bringing the solution, which has been successful in those areas. And then we can just replicate them in Ghana, you know. So this conference is rather going to save the country a lot of funding, lots of money, because we have specialists who have done this elsewhere. For example, one of the presenters is Gerard Kaufman. This is the person who have worked in infrastructure flooding in the, New Jersey and Delaware. Actually, he is the guru when it comes to flooding. And then he did a presentation talking about how this, some of these issues can be addressed.
Ni Ato Okai is a professor of civil and environmental engineering at the University of Delaware and interim academic director of the University Cybersecurity Initiative. He spoke with me from Wilmington, Delaware, here in the U.S. Uganda, defense lawyers for former presidential candidate Dr. Kizza Besigye has welcomed a court ruling that reduced cash bail imposed on the jailed opposition leader. This after the defense lawyers appealed a city court's ruling which imposed an estimated $8,080 for the release of Besigye. He refused to pay and asked his lawyers to appeal the ruling. The High Court, however, ruled this week in an appeal that the opposition leader must now pay a reduced amount, about $800. Besigye was charged with inciting violence. He was arrested at a rally where he called for mass action against the soaring prices of essential goods. Civil society and opposition parties are also calling on the government to find solutions to, in their words, ease the economic burden and challenges Ugandans face. For reaction to the High Court's ruling, I reached lead attorney Arias Lukwago. He is also the Lord Mayor of the Ugandan capital, Kampala.
Well, this ruling speaks volumes about the state of affairs in our country, the way rights are being abused with impunity, and it's really very unfortunate. You can see originally the lower court had directed Dr. Westby to pay cash bail of around $8,000. Now it has been slashed to $800. And to me, this is still high, considering the magnitude of the case, because it's just a petty case, a small case of incitement to violence, which under our penal law would attract a penalty of a fine that is roughly $400. But that said, we are glad that finally he has got some reprieve, because this is not total freedom. He has not regained his liberty.
Why are you saying he has not totally gotten his freedom?
Yeah, obviously he has been shifted from one detention center to another, because even when he was walking out of CPS, out of the station there, they couldn't allow to access his vehicle to travel in his private vehicle back to his home. No, they stopped him. They intercepted him and they pounced on him, arrested him. They bundled him into a patrol vehicle and then drove at a breakneck speed up to his home. And they have sealed off his home right now. No one can access. He cannot even be allowed to get out. Even his vehicle has been confiscated. So you can see he has not gained his liberties. He has not regained his freedom.
Some people are saying that you've gotten a victory in court, with the judge even saying that the 30 million shillings was too high. He reduced it and even said it's a miscarriage of justice. Some people said it's a victory you should take home and be happy about and not even be worried about whether it's still too excessive. How do you respond to that?
Well, you have to look at the genesis of the matter, where it all started from. It was about a campaign to awaken Ugandans about the governance issues, the deteriorating economic situation in the country, where the regime is extravagant, they have not come to the rescue of the ordinary people, and so on and so forth. So those issues, yes, how do I celebrate? You can't celebrate when the country is being plugged into a problem. If a country is being plugged into an abyss.
Since women activists who demonstrated days after Dr. Besigye's arrest to demand his release and against the rising cost of essential goods are also currently in detention, including your own Deputy Lord Mayor, Dorry Nyanjura. What is your reaction?
The regime is using the criminal justice system to continue perpetrating the injustices we are complaining about, we are fighting against. And that's the dimension you have to deal with. Because we should be running for courts of law for rescue. We should be going to courts of law for justice. Now you can imagine that these women were treated and were brought before court. We applied before bail and the court as we are making our application, said, time up. It has clocked 5 p.m. You'll come back. When we came back the following day and presented the application and the sureties, then the state said, I need 2 weeks within which to scrutinize the documents for the sureties. And the magistrate had done the matter to Tuesday. That was Tuesday last week. The magistrate had the audacity of adjourning to Tuesday next week, if you can imagine. And this is all done in abuse of the due process. So, no, that's where the problem is now, that the Bill of Rights, which is mentioned in our Constitution, has been rendered in negatory. It is useless. Some sort of useless now. So that's where we have a problem, that the Constitution of Uganda is no longer supreme. And that's the reason we have invited Ugandans to invoke the Constitution, which commands them to rise to the occasion and deal with the situation when the sitting regime veers off the constitutional path.
Arias Lukwago is lead defense attorney for Dr. Chisa Besigye. He's also the Lord Mayor of the Ugandan capital, Kampala. He spoke with me from Kampala. Maize, Zambia's primary staple crop, is under attack from fall armyworms. Its migratory pest that rapidly moves through fields, eating young plant stems at lightning speed, leaving devastation in their path. It is estimated that 10% of Zambian farms in six provinces have already been affected. For VOA, Kathy Short reports from the Zambian capital, Lusaka.
Michael Chongo is a 71-year-old farmer in Zambia's southern province. He's one of many trying to control the outbreak.
They were giving us one bottle to be shared among three farmers, but despite spraying in my field, the armyworms are still attacking my maize. Some farmers have even resorted to applying sand on the maize stalks as a way to control the pest.
According to the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, the effects of the armyworm invasion could be catastrophic for Zambia. Celestine Luatula is the FAO's program associate in Zambia.
The food security situation of the country was at stake, and therefore FAO offered to support with funds totaling to $500,000 in order to ensure that the poor armyworm is controlled. And as FAO, we would like to see that we work together, because this is something that cannot be controlled by one department.
Unique Mapanza is the Ministry of Agriculture's senior national agricultural coordinator. He says measures have been put in place to control the four armyworms.
And let me appeal to the farmers to say, let them not just sit idle, let them quickly run to DAQUA's office and get the chemicals so that they can start spraying these worms. The government has already provided this, and you are not paying anything. It's a matter of going there. You tell them where your field is, and then they'll give you the chemicals and you start spraying. You discover that the farmers have done the weeding, but there's more or less like irregular visits to see what is happening, taking place in their fields.
The government has declared the outbreak a national disaster and dispersed over $3 million for pest control. Military planes have sprayed affected areas in an attempt to stop the infestation. However, experts worry that four armyworms' capacity to burrow into the center of maize plants will make it difficult to control the outbreak using pesticides. The FAO says the pest is actually a moth originally found in the Americas that over the past few years has migrated to most African and many Asian countries. The UN organization says, according to some estimates taken from African countries a few years ago, smallholder farmers could lose up to 18 million tons of maize. And if not controlled, the worms could also threaten many other crops, including vegetables, sorghum, wheat, and millet. I'm Kathy Short for VOA News in Lusaka, Zambia.
On the next Free Talk Africa, a massacre at a Catholic church in Nigeria claims the lives of many and leaves a community shaken to its core. In the United States, a gunman opens fire at a school in Texas and kills children and teachers. Can anything be done to stop senseless mass shootings? Join me, Heidi Adams, as we discuss these issues on the next Free Talk Africa, this Wednesday at 18:30 UTC.
Hi, I'm Kim Lewis. Join me and our panel of journalists as we discuss the top stories of the week, including analyzing the first televised account presented by the U.S. House Select Committee investigating how the January 6, 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol building unfolded. Join us for Issues in the News this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs and Music from our African collection. But first, a new report by the think tank called the International Center for Dialogue Initiatives warns that countries in the Middle East and North Africa will soon face a rise in armed conflict due to climate change. This, as the countries in the Sahel as well as Libya and North Africa are experiencing an escalation of violence. The report says socioeconomic shocks due to inclement weather conditions such as heat waves, massive wildfires, and rising sea levels will lead to loss of livelihoods. They also create an enabling environment for extremist groups to grow their influence and cause more conflict. A major recommendation of the report is calls for the UN Security Council to include the impact of climate change on international security as part of its primary responsibility for maintaining peace and security. For more details on the report, I read Jamal Ben Omar. He is a former UN Special Envoy for Yemen and UN Undersecretary General. He is also the chair of the International Center for Dialogue Initiatives.
The report makes a very important point, which is that the devastating effect of climate change, glacier melting, rising sea level, food shortages, all this will create socioeconomic shocks and will result in loss of livelihoods for large swaths of the populations around the world. And competition over scarce resources could lead to conflicts, more mobility, migrations, and tensions. And this is something that we see already happening in Africa. So the drought and environmental degradation that part of the continent is experiencing could trigger a succession of new conflicts and wars. And this is going to be more damaging to the continent than anything that we have seen. And this is the reason why, in the report, we make a number of recommendations.
We are seeing remnants of pieces of conflicts here and there, but how soon are we going to see an escalation of these anticipated conflicts, especially with the day-to-day happening of climate change and the socio-economic impact that this could have?
I think we are seeing this devastation already and the conflict resulting from that. I think it's happening. It's very clear, what we see in the Sahel. But even some countries that, in theory, are very stable and so on. I was talking to friends from the country where I come from, Morocco, and I was told that I've seen this in the news before, that there have been clashes, between herders who have no grazing land and with sedentary populations. There is the issue of water management, issues that's going to appear. And, water has no borders and, with national government, taking precautionary measures, this could, we see this already clearly with the Nile River and the conflict that has been there now for years and with no prospects of a resolution. This is a conflict that, involves all the countries sharing the water resources of the Nile River.
Mr. Ben Omar, looking at some of these countries adversely affected by the ongoing climate change, do you think the sub-regional bodies, including ECOWAS, the Horn of Africa, East Africa region, SADC, and perhaps CEMAC in the Central Africa region, under the umbrella of the African Union, will have the capacity to develop this kind of measures or structure to combat this anticipated or escalating conflict that the report enumerated?
Well, the good news about Africa is that Africa has developed a robust mechanism for dealing with conflict and conflict prevention and so on within the African Union. This was a major development. And then the good news is that we see regional organizations taking responsibility, like ECOWAS. We have seen ECOWAS action when it was the crisis in Gambia, You know, we see concerted action of heads of states who often go on mission to the countries concerned. This is good news. And we see similar efforts, you know, in other parts of Africa, East Africa, and SADC and so on. To start, you know, I think it's a conversation is needed, you know, within the African Union and other sub-regional organizations. And I'm sure from this discussion, some ideas will emerge on what would be appropriate in terms of new mechanism for addressing these new conflicts.
All right, Mr. Benoma, what are some of the major recommendations contained in the report?
Well, the one thing we can't help observing is that there has been reluctance at the UN to address this issue head-on, although there have been attempts by some members of the Security Council, but there has been pushback. What we are seeing in our report is that the Security Council should include climate change, its effects on international security, as part of its primary responsibility for the maintenance of peace and security. You know, this is an issue that cannot be ignored.
Jamal Benoma is a former UN Special Envoy for Yemen and UN Secretary General. He is also the chair of the International Center for Dialogue Initiatives. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospects in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under-Secretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Much is being discussed in present circumstances about the sanctity of a rule-based world order. And in this regard, the Western world has been insisting and calling on African states and other states in the Global South to roundly condemn Russia for its military intervention in Ukraine. Obviously, African states have always considered sacred the territorial integrity of all its member states of the United Nations. What is of some concern is that the rules of a stable world order are not always respected even by the United Nations. And here we have a situation of Western Sahara. In previous commentary, we have followed and examined the origin of the problem, the decisions that have been taken first by the OAU, the predecessor of the African Union, to admit the Polisario Front and the Sahrawi Republic as a full member of the OAU and now of the African Union. Similarly, the General Assembly have recognized the observer status of the Sahrawi Republic at the United Nations. You also have the curious situation that today both Morocco and the Sahrawi Republic are members of the African Union. With the passage of time, member states of the international community are moving away from the decision of the Security Council. That decision was that the final decision about the sovereignty of the Western Sahara will be decided when the people of that territory have been given the opportunity to pronounce on the self-determination rights. Over 30 years, nothing much has been done to carry out this referendum. Nevertheless, Morocco has adopted laws, regulations to absorb Western Sahara in its territorial integrities against decisions of the Security Council. Decision which under Article 25 of the Charter should be respected by all member states. Only Algeria has stood up to defend the decision of the Security Council when Morocco announced that it was absorbing Western Sahara. Algeria broke relations with Morocco. And last week, when Spain decided that it would recognize the autonomous status of Western Sahara within the territorial boundaries of Morocco, Algeria also responded. It disregarded a long-standing agreement between Algeria and Spain and ended many relationships with that country, except to carry on the sale of fuel in order not to disturb the equilibrium in Europe. Why is it at this critical stage is not much being said about the African Union? In fact, cynical remarks have been made that while Algeria is taking this decision, it too recognizes the reality that Morocco will never give up Western Sahara. There are even reports that other members of the United Nations, such as France, the Netherlands, are sympathetic to the position being taken by Spain. Also, we are hearing from the United States that the Biden administration disagrees with the decision of former President Trump and that the United States recognize the decision taken by the Security Council. Let me say that this is not an academic exercise. This is a very serious problem of statecraft and the observance of the rules of the Charter, which is much discussed today. But this is not the only thing that where the African Union has remained silent. Recently, Mauritius took its case to the International Court of Justice, ICJ, regarding decision made by the British government at its independence to separate some islands from Mauritius. The decision of the ICJ was the islands belong to Mauritius. And the response of the British government was that the ICJ was giving only an advisory opinion and it is not bound to respect it, and added that while it recognized the claim of Mauritius, the islands are vital to the security of the West and that the base which the United States has in one of these islands will remain. Yet, not a word from the African Union. And this comes at a time when the European Union has demonstrated staunch defense of its interests in Europe and fighting tooth and nail that everyone should respect that. So the call to the African Union is this. Where do you stand? Are you prepared to accept the decision of Morocco to violate your decision as well as that of the Security Council? Please respond. Thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Juna, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent.
Not because of you, I be on the phone all night long ago. Don't be smarting when you do it to me, oh no, no, no. I be on my business, shawty, but you be on my mind, shawty. Let me live it, full of my mind, honey, oh, oh. Kiss me to the cellular, kiss me to the phone. Can't you see I'm into ya, can't you see I'm in love? Kiss me to the cellular. Give me to the
real life. Like I know I see be for real life. For real life. In a my condo, loving up your body in pasta so more. If I hit you, it's my combo. Can you never ever let me go? Dancing,
kiss me all the time. Kiss me to the bone. Can't you see I'm into ya? Can't you see I'm in love? Kiss me to the cellula. Kiss me to the bone. Yeah, that's where my medulla. I can't talk alone. Oh no.
the girl a wine and them a conquer. Pop, rewind, run it again. 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 Who's there? Who's there? Tell me who's there? I bring my girls and my twins there. And we a party, we a rave, and we don't care. We don't care. Bring it over. No. Send it over. No. Bring it over. No. Me want send it over. Sorry, no. Me give it to the girl, them hot and cold. Girl, them mineral, hot and gold. Yo, man, I'm mad with a road. Dedicate this one to the young and the old. Pop, rewind.
What's that?
Run it again. Rewind. Run it again. Rewind. Run it again. Rewind. Run it again. Oh, me girl, you a bad man. You make your man them bad man. If you know day, I'm sad. If I don't, then you drive by. Can you get that like Santa? No time to be banter. Shake it like it's from Atlanta. How you feeling with the Panther?
Black Panther.
Come. Run, come. Up in a day dance, ready to not encore. See the girl a wine and them a come. Run it again. Run it again.
Yeah.
That was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Maglan Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America in Washington. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we're on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, including producer Saida Hamdoun, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, if a child washes his hands, he could eat with kings. I'm your host, Peter Clote in Washington. Good evening, Africa.